Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. New York advocates are urging Governor Kathy Hochul and the state legislature to support bills to reform the criminal justice system. The Legislative Gazette's Alexander Babby has more.
We need
community, not changes.
Community,
not changes.
As the year winds down and preparations are underway for the upcoming state legislative session that begins in January, advocates are packing the New York State Capitol in Albany to draw attention to issues they want tackled in the new year. On Monday, advocates who were formerly incarcerated or affected by family members who are behind bars called for sentencing reform. Lukey Forbes, who was sentenced in connection with a violent assault in Albany when he was 15, was released when he was 24. He says he and other activists are not asking the state to be soft on crime.
We're asking for judges to look at individuals, to not see a case as if people are not involved. Because people are involved.
The coalition of advocates is seeking passage of three bills. The Second Look Act allows those behind bars who were sentenced to a decade or more to have their sentences reviewed. The Earned Time Act allows sentences to be shortened through good time and merit time programs. The Marvin Mayfield Act would eliminate mandatory minimum sentences. Forbes says he understands the criminal justice system personally. He says he fell into the wrong crowd as his mother was dying of AIDS when he was young.
When I ended up hanging around older peers who committed an assault and robbery that they testified that I did not hit the victim, did the courts look at me as a child? No. They looked at me as a charge. And I blew trial, and I was ridiculed, I was made fun of by the judges.
Jamie Bailey Warren, whose husband Stephen has been incarcerated for two decades on second-degree murder and robbery charges, says defiant hope keeps her going.
Defiant hope challenges us to envision a system where justice is truly just, where rehabilitation is prioritized over punishment, where sentencing is fair, where individuals are given second chances, and where the cycle of incarceration is broken by addressing the root causes of crime, such as poverty, education gaps, and mental health issues.
Warren, a special education teacher at Long Lake Central School District, shared some of a letter from her husband, sharing his view he had been wrongfully convicted.
I've lost time. Time that I will not get back under any circumstance. Every day has been a struggle, mentally as well as physically and spiritually. Our judicial system seems to only perpetuate the injustices we face and hand down excessive prison sentences that destroy the family structure and take individuals away from their communities.
Melanie Trimble, director of the Capital Region chapter of the New York Civil Liberties Union, says criminal justice reform would be racial justice. She noted disproportionate impacts of strict sentencing on minorities.
New York's half-century-long scourge of mass incarceration and unduly harsh sentences are policy choices that continue to ravage entire communities. The safest communities are the ones with the most resources, not the highest jail populations.
Terrell Overton, a member of the Albany-based Center for Community Alternatives, was paroled earlier this year after more than 20 years behind bars for second-degree murder, a charge for which he says he was wrongfully convicted. Overton calls himself an example of the school-to-prison pipeline.
I was 18 years old when I first stepped foot in Sing Sing. When I came home, I was 40 years old. That's two decades of the most formidable years of my life spent in a cage. During those years, I grew up. I changed. I went from being a gang member to a mentor. from someone who people feared to someone they trusted.
Daryl Johnson of the Albany-based Center for Law and Justice served a decade-long sentence for dealing drugs in New York City. While he acknowledges dealing was wrong, he believes the sentence he received was based more on his zip code than any actual harm done.
It was not a war on drugs. It was a war on us.
That's right.
18 of us from 117th Street ended up incarcerated. I spent years locked up in Auburn, Dannemora, Groveland.
All three bills are currently idling in committee. A spokesperson for Governor Hochul said the Democrat will review the legislation should it pass both houses of the legislature. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Alexander Babby.
You were listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down for a conversation with New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. We spoke about Governor Kathy Hochul's veto of a transparency bill. The bill would require state agencies to post information not currently available to the public on lucrative contracts awarded to private entities. DiNapoli, a fellow Democrat, says he's disappointed in the governor's veto.
In fairness to Governor Hochul, she has been better on this issue, you know, than the prior administration. The legislature restored much of our contract oversight back. However, this is the big however, still under this governor and with the current legislature, in some limited circumstances, they have continued to, by statute, usually as part of budget language, write us out of our usual check and balance contract review in some specific areas. And then you have the whole issue of emergency contracts, which we understand, COVID being the most recent significant example, there are certain situations where you do have to declare an emergency and, in the interest of efficiency and speed, have the process short-circuited, if you will. I would still argue, unless it's a real dire emergency, you should never short-circuit it because we know how to turn things around quickly when you need to. But that being said, at the very least, what our argument has been, if this is going to happen, if you're going to exempt these contracts, which could be of many, many thousands of dollars, hundreds of thousands in some cases, from a controller review, which is what we're set up to do, to, you know, look out for taxpayer interest. At the very least, after the fact, post the information. Our original bill that was vetoed last year would require the contract itself to be posted within 30 days. The governor vetoed it, you know, arguing that it was an onerous requirement. Well, I don't agree with that assessment, but in an effort to try to make it easier, we amended the bill, and I have to give credit to the legislature for unanimously passing it and Senator Cooney and Assembly Member Solage for continuing to sponsor this. And we amended it to say within 30 days, the agency has to post basically a summary of the contract. Who did the contract go to? What was the amount? A brief description of it. How did the contract relate to an emergency? If, in fact, it was an emergency, was there any competition in soliciting for the contract? You know, basic information. David, I'll just sum it up in this way. If the only way to have accountable government is if you have transparency. And this bill, to me, was not a significant change, but a very important change. And I was very disappointed that, once again, she vetoed it, again suggesting that it's onerous. I don't agree at all. So I'm hoping the legislature will take it up again next year. And I hope the governor will pardon the expression, see the light on this one, because it is about shining a light on government operations.
Well, yeah. And, you know, we have this incredible wave of cynicism, not only in politics and government, but in most of our institutions right now.
Yeah.
Doesn't it make more sense, especially from the governor of the state, to open up and show what's in these contracts? Will the legislature, do you think, is just dead in the water now? Or do you think they'll make a serious revisit on this in 2024?
Well, the sponsors, Senator Cooney and Assemblymember Solage, have been very forthright saying that it's an issue they're going to continue to champion. So the fact that it passed unanimously, I'm hopeful it'll come up again. Perhaps we'll have further conversation with the second floor and see what their real objections are. But I just think a lot of it's about tone, if I could put it that way. When you have a proposal like this that really is not a monumental change, but sends a strong message about openness, which is what we should be striving for, to keep vetoing it, I just think raises more suspicions. As you say, we're in a very tough time in terms of confidence in government. You know, not having this information being fully disclosed really just raises questions. And I'm not ascribing any nefarious motivation on this, but to me, it should have been a no-brainer to sign it.
Well, speaking of motivation and tone, let's talk for a minute about the congestion pricing plan. You and I have discussed this in the past. Mm-hmm. The governor had the original plan, which he paused. I think it was for 5 or 6 months. The original plan was going to charge $15 to motorists during peak times of the day below 60th Street, Manhattan. And she paused that before the election, right? Yeah. And then the election comes. If you're reading the tea leaves, you say, well, this is a tax. You don't want to have that on New Yorkers' minds before the election. The election comes and goes. Democrats do fairly well in New York. They do well. And then, you know, oh, here comes the congestion pricing plan again, revived. Now it's $9. You know, as the chief financial officer, I know this is New York City and the MTA, but you look at these things as well. What are you making of all this?
Well, I mean, look, first of all, the MTA to have a fully funded capital plan is essential to the public transit system, public transportation in the New York City metro area functioning. And that is essential to the economy. And certainly the New York City metro area is essential to the economy of the state of New York. So it is of everyone's interest, even if you're not living in Brooklyn or in Westchester or whatever. What I had said, and I'm sure we talked about it on your show when we talked about this going back a couple months ago, I had no, you know, from the controller's perspective, no opinion plus or minus on congestion pricing. What I said is that the MTA capital plan must be funded. If you want to have the system in a state of good repair, meaning when you have old subway cars and old trains that are outliving their useful life, they've got to be replaced. When you've got stations that need to be made handicap accessible in compliance with ADA and commitments that have been made, that has to be done and costs a lot of money. When you have to deal with the issue of resilience, building it into the system because of climate change and severe storms, that takes money. All of this takes money. So my position always was, you have to fund the capital plan. If you do not want congestion pricing, and obviously many people have not been in favor of it, you got to come up with the money some other way. And what it came down to is exactly as you said, the governor put a pause on it. There was some question whether that pause was permanent, temporary, would it be congestion pricing light? And as you point out, she did come back with a version of congestion pricing, at least initially, is lower than the $15 original charge. It'll be phased back up to that. There are still lawsuits pending. We'll see what'll happen with that. I think the good news in terms of my concern for funding the MTA's capital plan is that the MTA will be able to fulfill its commitments as far as the current 2020-2024 capital plan. However, David, they've unveiled a new capital plan. And now that capital plan for the next cycle, I think the gap of about $33 billion. So the MTA is not out of the woods. In the short run, yes, this money will help with the priority projects that they need to spend money on. I'll channel my old dear friend, Dick Ravitch, whose voice I miss tremendously. And he, as you know, was a wonderful champion for the MTA.
Oh, yeah.
And he always said, remember, he saved the MTA back in, I guess, the 70s when it was really in bad shape. If you want people to ride the trains and the subways and the buses, you have to have a system in a state of good repair. We are not back to the ridership level that we were pre-pandemic. The MTA needs the fare box revenue most of all for its operating expenses. So the interplay between how you fund the capital plan, how you maintain the system, people using the trains and the subways and the buses and revenue, it's all interconnected. And it's not to say there aren't other issues. There are issues of public safety, of cleanliness, concern for, you know, incidents happening on the subway, mental health, you go down the list. But in terms of what the MTA certainly has a very direct control over, that is the maintenance of the infrastructure, the capital plan is essential. So I still say, David, to your listeners who are saying, no, I don't want congestion pricing, unless we come up with another way to fund the MTA's capital plan, that's the solution that state leadership has decided on.
That's Democratic New York State Comptroller Tom DiNapoli. You were listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. A new survey shows healthcare providers' preferences and how they communicate with New Yorkers looking to quit smoking. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
The New York State Smokers Quit Line, a free service that provides counseling to those trying to quit, recently released its 2024 Tobacco Cessation and New York State Healthcare Professional Survey. The survey asked healthcare professionals to share their concerns and preferences for communicating with patients about quitting smoking. Pat Bax is marketing coordinator at Roswell Park Cancer Institute, which performed the survey.
We did the survey to learn from New York State licensed healthcare professionals about their preferences and their needs for the types of tobacco cessation resources, and tobacco referring to the use of manufactured or combustible commercial products and vape products, not the sacred medicinal and traditional use of tobacco by Native American nations and other indigenous groups. And also to find the best ways to provide those resources. Obtaining this information helps us in our marketing and outreach efforts here at the Quit Line.
More than 2,500 licensed healthcare professionals fully completed the survey, whose findings indicate that, compared to other forms of communication, email is still the most preferred channel for health professionals to receive tobacco cessation information from the Quit Line. Tony Estrin is the New York Quit Line's PR and communications manager.
When you break down the responses by region and by profession. So if you're a social worker and you're working closer to the New York City area, you tend to just want the electronic information. Don't give me the handouts, give me the electronic version. But conversely, if you're, say, a dentist or working in Central New York, maybe you want that piece of paper or brochure.
The documents requested by healthcare providers offer a glimpse into the habits of smokers. Astrin says statewide, dentists and social workers want printed, downloadable fact sheets. He says survey respondents, especially dentists, indicated they want to see more cannabis-related materials. Astrin says most Quitline participants tend to be 55 or older and smoke traditional cigarettes, but he says many young people are using vaping products.
We asked if professionals wanted to see more specific patient or client materials or offerings from us pertaining to youth and young adults, and most said yes, especially nurses, especially those in the Hudson Valley, maybe not so much among physicians and pharmacists, but about three quarters said yes. So of those folks, this is the real juicy nugget, which if you've been seeing the Quit Line in the news lately and coverage of the survey, we then asked those people, okay, here's a number of different topics. Which of these, just check all that apply, expresses your views on youth and young adults? And here was what I think was the most interesting finding of the whole survey, is that nearly two-thirds of healthcare professionals in the state believe that today's youth and young adults are experiencing a vaping epidemic.
According to the New York State Health Department's 2022 New York Tobacco Survey, 54.8% of middle school students and 54.8% of high school students who currently vape say they want to quit. Astrin says with vaping on the rise, the Quit Line encourages users to talk with their healthcare professionals and assess available Medicaid or health insurance benefits for medication support. New York residents can call 1-866-NY-QUITS or text QUIT NOW to 333-888 for coaching and resources free of charge.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has stepped in to save a historic lighthouse at risk of sinking into the Hudson River. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King with more.
The Hudson Athens Lighthouse has helped ships steer around the Hudson Middle Ground Flats for 150 years. Volunteers with the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society, the community group maintaining the site, have warned that extensive wear and tear at its base due to commercial barge traffic could cause the lighthouse to collapse beneath the waves. Speaking in Athens Monday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer announced the federal government won't let that happen.
This project really matters to me, to Greene and Columbia counties, and to the whole Hudson Valley, anyone who loves the Hudson Valley.
Earlier this year, the nonprofit National Trust for Historic Preservation put the lighthouse on its list of 11 most endangered historic places in the U.S. By becoming part of the Army Corps of Engineers Protection Program, Schumer says the site will receive the funding and labor it needs to shore up its infrastructure. While a specific dollar amount was not mentioned Monday, volunteers with the Preservation Society have previously estimated the total cost to be around $7.5 million. New York District Commander Colonel Alexander Young says the Army Corps allocated $50,000 for a feasibility study earlier this year. Next, it will develop a restoration plan.
We are fortunate that the Hudson Athens Lighthouse Preservation Society has done a tremendous amount of work already. So we've got the survey and some of the design work that's going to make our job easier. But we're looking to incorporate that into our work to allow us to streamline and really act with a sense of urgency here.
Volunteers at the lighthouse have warned it could sink within the next few years. The lighthouse is still in operation, not just as a beacon, but as a historic site and tourist attraction. The Preservation Society hosts tours of the site, reachable by boat, to teach about the Hudson River's role in American commerce and what life was like in Hudson and Athens during the late 19th century. Van Calhoun, chair of the Preservation Society's Restoration Committee, says the lighthouse used to run on oil lamps, meticulously cared for by a lighthouse keeper and their family. But nowadays, it uses an automatic, solar-powered LED.
It represents a way of living that used to happen, too. And the funny thing is, you can't get to it. So it remains a little bit of a mystery to a lot of people.
The cargo ships running up and down the Hudson River today are a lot bigger than those in 1874, and that's what is causing the lighthouse to be unstable. Calhoun says these barges make huge waves as they go by, and over time, the push and pull of the water has sucked out boulders and mud from the base of the lighthouse, exposing the wood pilings it was built on.
So the lighthouse is still doing its job, but it's an unforeseen consequence to the shipping that we have today that we never envisioned we'd ever have.
The site previously received two $500,000 state grants to help stabilize the structure. Calhoun says the Preservation Society has discussed a range of options to shore up the lighthouse since 2022, from smaller plans that would buy them a few more years to more extensive projects. Calhoun says they're aiming for the best option possible, the 100-year fix, as he calls it, and the Army Corps seems to be on board.
It's been pretty rewarding. And everybody has been so positive along the way. But the Corps of Engineers deciding that we're worthy as a project and that they're going to do it is just tremendous.
The Army Corps didn't give a specific start date Monday, but Schumer pledged to continue pushing the issue. Calhoun says the Preservation Society is also working on a project to replace the lighthouse's roof. But if you pass it at night, you'll still see it decorated with lights for the holidays for the 36th straight year. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You were listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. The holidays may be full of hustle and bustle, but that doesn't mean you can't still enjoy them. A psychologist from SUNY Upstate is giving advice on how to protect your mental health during this busy holiday season. The New York Public News Network's Jessica Kane with more.
The popular lyrics, "All is calm, all is bright," may not apply to a lot of people over the next few months as those holiday to-do lists pile up. Dr. Rich O'Neill, a clinical psychologist at SUNY Upstate, says stress can be normal this time of year.
One of the main things that happens is we have this huge crunch of additional things to do that we don't usually have in our schedule. And that time crunch alone raises stress.
O'Neill says to fight anxiety, try mindfulness. If someone has a negative thought, they can identify why they're worried and think about what resources they have to fight their concerns. And he says, think about what you can do today to fight stress in the future.
Start working now rather than Christmas Eve going out shopping crazily, running around, you know, looking for stuff, and be realistic around your money as well. Do a budget.
If you have big plans with family and friends, O'Neill says think about simplifying your shopping and budget by trying something like Secret Santa. And if you have a big gathering planned, you can keep the tone positive by avoiding controversial topics.
If somebody insists, I say, look, I don't talk about politics and religion. I want us to be here and just have a good time together. That's my goal. Have fun. I love you. I know you love me. So let's do something fun.
O'Neill suggests keeping more neutral topics in mind that you can introduce, like kids, the weather, or sports teams you both enjoy. On the other hand, loneliness can also be a big strain on mental health during the holidays.
There are a huge number of people who are alone. And then if you don't want to be alone, you don't like that, you can structure things into your life so you can have time with people on those holidays or do other things,
including volunteering, which is known to boost mental health. And O'Neill says, don't forget the season is supposed to be about joy. So think about your values. For him, it's family.
I want to be with the grandkids, right? So I orient my life around that and move things out of the way that prevent you from engaging in things that you like.
I'm Jessica Kane.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2452. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Happy holidays. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.